just went running by. Oh, the snow's pure and white on the earth, rich and brown. Just another Sunday morning in my quiet mountain town.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for September 5th, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this afternoon is Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray. Michael is a columnist for BroadwayStars.com, also writes for NPR, and also has a business at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning on this beautiful day after the hurricane that didn't really happen.
Isn't that, what a beautiful day. I was just mentioning to Matthew to wake up without having to need air conditioning. It's a great,
I know, it's fantastic
day out there. Also with us, as I mentioned, is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for TalkinBroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, James. It is so good to have you back. I can't even tell you.
Oh, I am telling you. nobody's more happy for me to be here than me. After carrying two kids through Disney for 10 days, I'm pretty happy to be back. I need a vacation from the vacation. So here we are in this beautiful, glorious fall weather, like somebody threw a switch, and we're getting ready for the fall season. And the fall season is mounting up as we see lots of different news. Things are going to give us some color as to what's happening. I don't think there's been any official word, but pretty much all the pundits have talked about Love Never Dies not making it to New York. Michael, what do you think about that?
Well, I guess it's not a huge surprise. Well, on the one hand, the reviews apparently were generally bad of the show in London. But as we all know, reviews are not the primary determining factor in an Andrew Lloyd Webber show especially. But my understanding is that also the word of mouth was not good. And also, you know, something I thought was fascinating is that apparently fans of the original Lloyd Webber Phantom were expressing their great displeasure about this show, even those who hadn't seen it, just because on the basis of what they had read about the plot. And in fact, this is really pretty extraordinary. I don't know if you caught this, but Lloyd Webber made a statement in which he basically got very angry at those people. And said something like, I think people really need to move on, or something like that. And he said something to the effect of that he thought it was sad that all of these Phantom groupies wouldn't accept something new. And I think it probably is not a really good PR move to diss the fans of your biggest success. But apparently, I've always been told that Lloyd Webber, for all his incredible financial success, is very insecure about his shows in terms of, because, well, the old joke is that he always had the audiences and the great financial success, whereas Sondheim always had the critics in his corner. And that's a little simplistic because it's not that black and white, of course, but there is a lot of truth to that. So anyway, Lloyd Webber got upset that these Phantom fans were rejecting Love Never Dies, and he made this statement against those people. And now it looks like the show is not coming to New York.
Yeah, don't turn on the fans, you know, they're, especially on the day of the day of the internet, when these fans can all group together and, you know, make or break a show. Matthew, so Love Never Dies looks like it's not coming, or at least is substantially delayed. What do you think?
Well, I have to say that I've listened to a little bits of the Love Never Dies cast recording, not the whole thing, but parts of it. And as usual with Andrew Lloyd Webber, I have to say that some of the music truly is beautiful. There is some very good stuff in it. But as with many of his shows, I'm just not sure that there is that much of a show there from a dramatic standpoint. I think I've said on the podcast before that it strikes me as kind of a dodgy dramatic situation to bring all of these characters from France to New York and try to continue on the story that say what you will about the original show, it works dramatically very well compared to a lot of the stuff we've seen since then from Andrew Lloyd Webber and other composers. And I don't know. I feel like with Andrew Lloyd Webber, it's always kind of a crapshoot about whether you get really something that sort of works in spite of itself or something that doesn't work at all. Now, what Michael Riedel had said in his column this week, which I'm sure we'll be linking on the news page, is that there is talk that Lloyd Webber is going to take two different productions of the show, quote unquote, on the road. One is going to be in Australia and one is going to be in Toronto, and they're both going to be completely separate, and then Lloyd Webber will pick which one he wants to come to New York. I mean, which one he thinks is better, has the stronger concept or whatever. And I think that's an interesting idea, but I think that if the problems with the show are really as severe as has been stated, that unless it's drastically rewritten, which as we know with Lloyd Webber shows very seldom happens, I don't think it's going to matter which production comes in, because it sounds to me like it has some problems at the elemental script level and probably the lyric level. I haven't listen to enough of the cast recording to really make a determination about that, because up until this week I thought it was coming in, and I prefer not to listen to recordings of shows that I know I'll be seeing and reviewing one day, so that I'm not influenced ahead of time.
The take on Lloyd Webber is that he has tended to work with collaborators who are not in the first rank, and supposedly because it's an ego issue. I mean, I can't say, but that is the take on him. I actually was heartened when I heard that Glenn Slater was going to be involved with Love Never Dies, because I thought his work on The Little Mermaid was excellent as a lyricist. But in this case, the book is being written by Slater with Lloyd Webber and Ben Elton. Yes, you know, I mean, I don't know how much input Glenn Slater had. And also, obviously, writing a book is not the same as necessarily as writing lyrics, which he did so well for The Little Mermaid. But it would be really interesting to see what would happen if Lloyd Webber ever collaborated with a really first-rate lyricist and or book writer.
It's
no coincidence, I think, that the quality of his shows generally has just really deteriorated since they stopped working together.
Yeah, Tim is he pulls out some really brilliant lyrics. If you reflect back on some of the nuances in Evita and in Jesus Christ Superstar, it's a shame that those two can't get back together and do something else.
I think they should. And there again, you know, they did reunite to write a song for the film version of Evita.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe they can get together again. But who knows? Maybe the old magic is just gone. I guess we'll never know.
Also, we didn't mention Jack O'Brien and Jerry Mitchell, which Michael Riedel's column outlined that there seemed to be a not only a scheduling conflict with Catch Me If You Can with Jack O'Brien and Jerry Mitchell, but that Andrew Lloyd Webber is a little bit demanding as an employer and on whims would demand that Jack O'Brien and Jerry Mitchell drop everything on their schedule to at his beck and call to be with him to go over this. So it's interesting that if this does come to fruition, where this two production team scenario competing, it sort of sounds like a setup for a reality series, doesn't it?
You know? Well, of course, you know, that wouldn't be unprecedented, because Andrew Lloyd Webber has been involved with those reality series in England,
yeah,
about casting his shows. And, you know, it's just going back to the Jerry Mitchell and Jack O'Brien thing, they've been involved with the project for a while, and Michael Riedel has been reporting pretty much ever since Love Never Dies first was announced and they started work on it, that Jack O'Brien and Jerry Mitchell were doing it for the money and didn't expect that there would be this long of a development process that would, you know, coincide with the Broadway production of Catch Me If You Can, which is part of the reason that they don't want to be involved anymore, because they have this other show coming on that they want to work on, and they weren't aware that they would still need to be working on Love Never Dies after such a long period of time. And I do understand that, but I guess I'm also sort of the opinion that, you know, if they have these two shows going on that they're working with, that they need to live up to both of their responsibilities. And it sounds like Andrew Lloyd Webber isn't satisfied with their work in any event. And frankly, just based on the previous work that I've seen from them, Love Never Dies is not necessarily something that I would associate with their particular talents. I generally think of them as more of a musical comedy team when it comes to doing musicals. But of course, Jack O'Brien has been involved with some major plays, Coast of Utopia and a number of others. So he's extremely talented, but I when he does musicals, it seems to me he usually sticks on the lighter side of things. And maybe that just wasn't the right choice for Love Never Dies. I don't know. Without seeing it, it's really hard to say where the problem is, but there certainly seems to be at least a few problems somewhere that are preventing Love Never Dies from being whatever it's capable of being.
Well, again, I don't quite understand the point of these two separate productions. Are they going to have two separate books? I mean, it seems clear that that's the major problem here.
Well, I assume that it's just the production itself, that they'll take the these two directors will do what directors are supposed to do and take the material in front of them and try to make it work for their respective audiences, however possible. But, you know, whether that'll be enough, it's hard to say.
Have you read the plot? I mean, it sounds...
I have read the plot. I haven't read the book. I've read plot synopses. Personally, I think it sounds... I'm going to be nice here, dreadful. I think that it sounds like a really poor story, and one that's, again, doesn't justify how you get these people from France in the 1880s to America in the early 1900s.
Came over on the ragtime ship.
Thank you, James. I don't understand. I don't understand, you know, what I don't understand how that's justified dramatically. And it sounds to me like maybe they didn't even try. Like, they just wanted to do the sequel thing and let's get the characters over here any way we can. And for me, that's not usually sufficient. But again, I haven't seen it. Maybe it works and maybe it does make sense. But it's always sounded like a very difficult idea to pull off.
I have a few things that I wanted to add in here, but that I didn't jump in before. We were talking about Love Never Dies as being a full employment project for Jerry Mitchell and Jack O'Brien. And I know the three of us, when we go on unemployment, we get $405 a week from the New York State. but seems like Jerry Mitchell and Jack O'Brien have a much better plan than we do. When they have some downtime, they're just going to hook up with Andrew Lloyd Webber and not make a full commitment to it, which is very sad, because I know these two gentlemen are just incredible, incredible talents and seemingly professional in all other ways. So I feel like there must be a better story there that nobody's talking about.
I don't know, guys. I'm a little surprised by the view that both of you have of this. So you really think that they are not filling their responsibilities?
No,
Michael,
what I'm saying,
it's not my view. It's what Michael Riedel has been reporting.
That's what I'm saying, is that I can't believe that Jerry Mitchell and Jack O'Brien are walking away from the production, because they're such consummate professionals in all other ways. And so there's got to be another story in there.
James, I agree with you partially, but I do think some of this does have to do with Catch Me If You Can, which has had a Broadway premiere reserved for a while. I mean, maybe they, I don't know, but I mean, if you have two conflicting shows like this, and one of them is one that you didn't think you'd still be working on a year and a half later, what do you do? How do you cancel the first one? I mean, it's a very difficult question that you don't face in many jobs. So I don't know from the show business angle how this all works. And
I don't think that it is. I think that this happens with lots of people who are, and not just in show business, but people that, you know, pretty much create their own business. You know, whether you're, you know, a director choreographer, or if you're a project manager for a big company and the project runs long, but you've got your next gig already set up. There's generally penalties in place for projects that run long. You know, and the penalties, they have to have good lawyers and contracts. Jack and Jerry that had outlined this, or else Andrew Lloyd Webber would be suing them. I think in Michael Riedel's columns suggests that they're going to get paid off. If Jack and Jerry were in the wrong here, I think Andrew Lloyd Webber would be suing them, not paying them off.
Right, right. And I think the short version of the story, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that O'Brien and Mitchell recognize that the essential problem is in the writing, not the direction and the choreography. And that there has been resistance or inability on the part of Lloyd Webber and the book and lyric writers to make changes. So that's sort of an impasse, isn't it?
There's a blog out there written by Chris Cagino called Everything I Know I Learned from Musicals. Have you guys ever read it before?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Chris is a very talented writer. And he points out that Hal Prince has this Paradise Found production at Meunier that we've talked about over the last couple of months. And and that Hal Prince has more or less said that the fault of this production was the production itself and not his fault, or and that it needs to be produced in a better way, on a larger scale, and he needs more people. I'm going to link to this article. It's interesting how you everybody's point of view is pointing at the other, whereas the development of a musical is so much of a collaborative effort between everybody involved, from the producer to the director to the creative team to the actors to, you know, the musical directors and the chorus members and everybody that's involved with it. But yet, when we run into bumps here, we have everybody and people at the top levels. I mean, Hal Prince and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Jerry Mitchell and, you know, all pointing fingers at each other, which is so, I guess it's all human. We're all human, aren't we? So do you guys have anything to say about that article?
Well, what a mistake for Prince to do it at the Meunier Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
If he wanted.
Yeah, we had this discussion before that, you know, I've certainly written about it on my column at Broadway Stars, where you have to give a show the size of production it needs, whether it's five people and two people playing kazoos, or whether it's 30 people on stage and 30 people in the pit. And if Prince made the mistake of going to the Meunier Chocolate Factory, where he was going to be encouraged, or given the size of the theater, required to have it be smaller than it needs to be, then he made a mistake that he needs to correct if the show is going to be the most it can possibly be. It's just that's the way it goes.
Absolutely. So from Love Never Dies, we go to a different Michael Riedel column, The Book of Mormon, Trey Parker, Matt Stone, and the Bobby Lopez show that seemed to have a backers audition here in New York recently. Michael seems to be anointing this as the next big, huge show, like on the scale of the producers. What do you guys think about the column and the show?
I don't know anything about the show. I wasn't at the backers audition where Michael Riedel reported that Stephen Sondheim was literally doubled over in laughter at what he was seeing. But I will say that I'm an enormous fan of not just South Park, but Matt Stone and Trey Parker's work in general. I think that they are really one of the finest and most creative and funniest comedy duos working in Hollywood today. And I pretty much love every single one of their movies. And I've been watching South Park for 13, 14 years, however long it's been on. And the movie version of South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, I think is one of the all-time best movie musicals. And it certainly is one of the best movies of the last 20 years or so, especially animated. I don't think there's any question, in my mind at least, that it surpasses a lot of the Disney efforts of that time period. They're extremely talented. They're extremely funny. Most of all, they're extremely original. There's no one else that has their voice and their willingness to take chances. Anyone who's followed the news in recent months and years has certainly heard about them making headlines, not only fighting the Church of Scientology with regards to some South Park episodes, but also radical Islam with a recent episode of South Park that Comedy Central actually censored and caused a big brouhaha there. So they're willing to take chances, and they're willing to step on toes. And that, I think, is something that's really sorely missing from Broadway today. Now, of course, they're doing a musical comedy about Mormonism, and that probably is not aiming at the biggest targets imaginable. But if it really is as funny as they say, I think the fact that the two creators are involved, and Trey Parker is directing it with Casey Nicholaw, who, of course, has been directing a number of musical comedies in recent years, including The Drowsy Chaperone, I think that it has enormous potential. And if it really is as funny as everyone says it is, it could be really just the event of this upcoming season. And I cannot wait to see it. I'm really looking forward to it, even more than I was, which is saying something. It was probably the single show I was looking forward to most, and now I want to see it even more. So I wish them the best of luck, and I'm counting the days.
The thing that's always impressed me most about Matt Stone and Trey Parker is that they're incredibly vulgar, but in an incredibly intelligent way. You know, I mean, anyone can make jokes, you know, with sex jokes and make jokes about fags and Jews and things like that. But if it's done with intelligence and the right amount of irony and the right style of irony, it can be really great. like when they do it, as opposed to really stupid as when other people do it. So I'm very hopeful about this show also, and it should be interesting because I think it is going to push the envelope in a major way. The only show I could think of offhand that was successful like that on Broadway was very successful. It was The Producers. And that did have some moments in it. That's sort of that school of if you offend everyone, it's okay as long as you spread it
equally
around.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this should be interesting because it is obviously the title of it. It's quite focused on the Mormon community. So I wonder if they will protest it or if they'll just ignore it and hope it goes away. Or it should be interesting to see what happens with that.
Well, Michael, Matt Stone and Trey Parker have been making fun of Mormonism for pretty much their entire career. And I don't recall hearing much from the Church of Latter-day Saints kind of decrying them or asking that they be censored or holding protests. That's not saying it hasn't happened, but I haven't heard about it. So I think that they're probably going to be okay. My personal feeling is that the Mormons have already sort of made peace with Matt Stone and Trey Parker about it. And from what I've seen of their work, generally, yes, they mock it and they have kind of revealed the teachings and the scripture and all that, but they do it the way they do most of their stuff, which is fairly lovingly. They don't, as you pointed out, Michael, they make fun of everyone more or less equally, and they don't do it from a position of hate, as I see it. To me, they do it from a position of pure comedy. Like, yeah, we just want to make fun of it, but we don't want to make it a crusade. We don't want to take it down. We just want to say it's out there. It's something you can laugh at. Here's a way to laugh at it. Then walk away, but that's it, you know? And to me, that's the way to do it. Because so many times when you have this kind of comedy, it ends up being something like it turns into an argument against or some sort of a tirade against these groups. And I don't think that'll happen here. I really think Matt Stone and Trey Parker will do that, but they'll leave you with kind of a message, well, these people aren't really so bad and we can make fun of it, but they're not really that much weirder than you are. And that's the way they handled it in one of the episodes of South Park where the kids in the town met up with someone who was really a devout Mormon, and they just sort of came to the conclusion, yeah, their religion's pretty weird, but it turns out some pretty good people, and that's, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. So maybe rather than focusing on what makes people different, you need to focus on what makes them good people. And I have a feeling that this show will ultimately do that as well. I really think these two have a lot of credit, and they have a lot of artistic and personal integrity that has shown through their work. And if that comes through here as well, I think that this could really be a good lesson in how to write comedy for the stage and for any other medium.
So the question is if we're talking this time next year, will this still be running and Spider-Man be closed, or what? Or do we think that?
One interesting thing is that I think that this show will be received differently in the wake of Proposition 8 than it might have been before that. You know, I do think that the Mormon support of Proposition 8 was pretty despicable and very, very hypocritical. And there seems to be a lot of gay people in the religion. It seems almost like more than in the general public. I don't know why that is, or maybe they're just more vocal when they come out because the religion is so oppressive. So I do think, you know, I agree with Matthew that Stone and Parker don't come from a position of hate when they make fun of these things, whether it be Mormonism or Scientology or whatever. They seem to go for the ridiculous aspect of them and hold them up to ridicule, kind of like The Producers does with Hitler. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't actually have very negative feelings about these things. I wonder, I guess, you know, we won't know unless we talk to them personally, and they probably wouldn't say anyway. So, yeah, in the wake of Proposition 8, it'll be interesting to see how the Book of Mormon goes over. And also, it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that specific area of gay marriage and repressed homosexuality among Mormons.
Well, I have a feeling, James, to go back to your original question, that the Book of Mormon will still be running. I am not even going to begin to predict what's going to happen with Spider-Man. That, to me, is the biggest imaginable question mark of the upcoming season, or really any season that we have seen in recent memory. If I were to say what I think is most likely, it's that it will crash and burn in a hugely phenomenal, unprecedented, fiery way. That's what I think is the most likely, just given how
Armageddon, the musical.
Exactly. Although if someone were to make that movie into a musical, I would probably blow up in flames too. But that's not the point. I think that it's probably most likely given the life that show has had so far, because it's lived so spectacularly and flown so high on the waves of gossip that it can't go out any way other than as brightly as it's shown already. So I just have a feeling that if it's to fail, it's going to fail big time. But I don't know that I think it will fail. I think that it could go anyway. There's so much money involved with it. I can't see everyone being willing to give up on it right away and just throw away the $50 million or whatever that they've put into it. So, I think that could go any number of ways. But I think that a year from now, the Book of Mormon will still be running. I don't know if it's going to be an enormous hit. I think that Matt Stone and Trey Parker have an enormous ace in the hole with regards to South Park, which they have an enormous amount of control over. And for those of you who aren't aware, they make every episode of South Park from the last 13 or 14 years available on the website southparkstudios.com for free. You can go there any time of day or night, watch any episode of the show except episode 201, which is the infamous one that Comedy Central censored, having to do with radical Islam and all of that, because the Prophet Muhammad played a major character. And technically they went back and also made the one in which Muhammad appeared as a good guy and took that one off as well for reasons too stupid to get into here, but you can read all about them online. But every other episode you can watch, and I think that they can tack on advertisements to the Book of Mormon there. Perhaps they'll work some deal out with Comedy Central where they can advertise it during the show. So the people who are aware and who watch South Park regularly might be exposed to the Book of Mormon in a way they might not otherwise be, and maybe that would entice them to go to New York and see the show and support Matt Stone and Trey Parker. So I don't know, but I think that they have a big enough reach that they might have a chance of attracting audiences kind of beyond the typical Broadway ticket buyers. And if that's the case, I don't think there's any limit on how long the Book of Mormon could run. I think that, you know, if we're comparing it to The Producers, which ran, you know, 6 years, 2,000-some performances or so, I think that that's not bad, and that the Book of Mormon could run that long for sure. Whether it will or not is anyone's guess, because they haven't written a lot for the stage, and the stage has different requirements from films, and who knows? It could just be that it could just be one of those cases where it works really great in reading, and when you get it on stage, it kind of dies. I have no idea.
Nick and Nora.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of possibilities here. But again, I think that they've proven themselves as incredible talents. And if Stephen Sondheim thought that it was literally fall out of his chair funny, I think that there's probably something there. So one way or another, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And I can't wait.
As to Spider-Man, I can't predict the success or failure of the show either, obviously. But I think one of the most interesting things about it is the theater, which, of course, started as the Ford Center and then was the Hilton and now is apparently the Foxwoods. And apparently it's been completely reconfigured as an arena, which I think is very interesting because, honestly, it seemed like nobody was really happy with the theater when it was a proscenium house. Everyone felt it was too large.
Oh, it was a total barn. Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the thing about that theater for me that was so ridiculous is the orchestra was so wide. I had one of the widest orchestras ever. It's a barn, or it was a barn, and it felt like you were in a theater much larger than 1,800 seats or whatever it held, which in the grand scheme of things isn't that much. The Gershwin and the Beacon Theater, and in some cases Radio City Music Hall, even felt more intimate because of the way the space was used, to me. So I don't know. I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, it's not the number of seats, it's just the scale of it. And I guess people generally feel that it worked best for Ragtime because that was a very large production. But it a lot of people feel that the theater helped to kill Young Frankenstein because comedy just doesn't work in a space that huge.
Well, Michael, Mel Brooks also had something to do with killing Young Frankenstein.
Well, yeah.
Because it wasn't very good. If the producers had opened in the Hilton or the Ford Center, it would have done better, I have a feeling. So.
Well, I mean, I agree with that. But anyway, my point is that it seemed like it was very hard to find shows that worked in the Hilton. And it should be interesting to see, I mean, whether Spider-Man runs 10 years or 3 months. I assume they will keep the theater in an arena configuration, and it will be interesting to have that kind of a venue in the Times Square area, which there, I mean, I guess the last time that happened was when Madison Square Garden used to be up on 50th and 8th, because there are, you know, I mean, probably more things that could work in it and an arena than as the kind of theater it used to be. Maybe Cirque du Soleil will come in there or things like that. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing because, as I say, it seems like everyone was unhappy with the Hilton and the Ford Center.
Well, Michael, that's a good point that you bring up about that. And in fact, I've just registered the name BroadwayBoxing.com.
Well, I guess they could use it for boxing. Why not? They could use it for maybe a revival of Starlight Express, you know.
Can we move on, please?
Starlight Express, please tell me yes. Are you there? Let me know.
Let me know.
Starlight Express, could you answer us? Yes. May I use the intro music for This Week on Broadway from Starlight Express a few weeks ago, and we got quite a few emails about that. I wanted to talk about, we've talked about Young Frankenstein and Spider-Man and the Book of Mormon. One of the things that these three things have in common, in fact, I'm not even sure this is true. I think it's true. Did Young Frankenstein go out of town before it came in?
Yeah.
It did?
It was in Seattle. It was in Seattle.
Oh, which might as well not have even existed. Okay. Oh, those West Coasters, they're so sensitive.
No, we're not. What are you talking about?
Those of you who don't know, Matthew is from the state of Washington.
I don't think I knew that.
But the I'm thinking about Book of Mormon and Spider-Man. Would they have benefited if they, you know, went out of town first? I don't want to talk about it as though it has already passed, but I'm pretty sure that Spider-Man's not going out of town.
How could it afford to go out of town?
Yeah, that's just not feasible.
There's so many different factors with Spider-Man, though. I mean, it didn't even have its financing until recently, given all the problems it had. And maybe the Book of Mormon will. I don't know if it's been announced yet, but that show still seems like it's in kind of the development stage. If they just had a reading of it, you know.
Well, it was the money stage. They were asking for checks, so they got to be going. And I thought the rumor is March, is that it's going to open on Broadway in March.
And it's opening cold?
I guess, because I've not heard about it opening out of town. I mean,
right?
You think Broadway needs lead times. The out-of-town theaters, they need
lead
times, you know, two-year lead times. I think about The Lord of the Rings, which, you know, I think The Lord of the Rings budget might put Spider-Man to shame. Is that correct, Matthew?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I thought that the Lord of the Rings budget was in the $50 million range, and they just stopped it cold in Toronto.
they did do it in London as well.
Yeah, they did it in London, did it in Toronto, but they decided not to bring it to New York.
Well, because the New York critics went up there and savaged it.
Yeah. Well, basically. But, you know, it seemingly it was done out of town as a litmus test to see if it's going to fly here, because I'm imagining in that it's much less expensive to mount it in a Mervish house up in Toronto than it is to, you know, right on 46th Street or something like that. I guess I don't know if there's an answer there, but it seems like it would be a smarter idea to take these things out of town first, even if it's a Toronto or a Chicago or even Seattle. Is that the name of that town? So,
what have you got against Seattle?
Gosh. Nothing.
Have you ever been to Seattle, James?
I have. Just I've been sleepless in Seattle. Yes. So that's that. All right. So next Sunday, September 12th at 11:30 a.m. is a yearly tradition called Broadway on Broadway, where a bunch of kids jump up on stage in the middle of the street like Fame and start singing for seemingly 6 or 7 hours. Right, Michael? Is that how that works?
Oh, well, it's not that long because they have to get they have to get to their matinees.
That's true. This is true. So
they announced the musical numbers. Did you want to run down them?
Yeah. Why don't we talk?
Let's see. The Addams Family, Just Around the Corner. American Idiot, St. Jimmy. Billy Elliot, Expressing Yourself. Chicago, We Both Reached for the Gun. Elf, There Is a Santa Claus. Fella, Zombie. In the Heights, When You're Home. La Cage aux Folles, We Are What We Are. The Lion King, Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Mamma Mia, Dancing Queen. Memphis, Steal Your Rock and Roll. Million Dollar Quartet Medley. Next to Normal, I Miss the Mountains. The Phantom of the Opera, All I Ask of You. I think they do that every year.
Yeah,
they do that every year.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, I Say a Little Prayer. But that's not the Bacharach song, is it?
I don't know. It would be interesting for them to do that.
Oh, you know what? You know what? It's maybe this is a misprint. It says Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, I Say a Little Prayer, and then it says Promises, Promises, Where Can You Take a Girl? So maybe that's a misprint.
Yeah.
Rain, Hey Jude, Rock of Ages, Wanted, Dead or Alive, West Side Story, Jet Song, and Wicked, The Wizard and I.
So that's Broadway on Broadway is next Sunday, September 12th at 11:30 a.m. right in the Times Square. Next, we'd like to talk about our town closing. Matthew, why don't you start us off there?
As I have said on this podcast many, many, many a time in the last year and a half or so, I think that the production of Our Town off Broadway at the Barrow Street Theater, directed by David Cromer, is absolutely brilliant. It is one of the best shows that I have ever seen, and I think it's unquestionably the best show of the last 2 years or so. So it only has a week left as we're recording this podcast. I have no idea if tickets are available. I do happen to know that the performances on the last day, Sunday the 12th, are both already sold out, and I have a feeling that many of the other performances leading up to it are also either sold out now or will be sold out by the time you're listening to this. But if you haven't seen it and you're near the New York area, really get your tickets now. It's something that I don't think you'll ever have another opportunity to see. It really is so special. It's one of the best revivals of a play that I've ever had the fortune to see. It's really remarkable, and it's completely faithful to the original Thornton Wilder text. It's really just a wonderful example of how to do, again, what I said earlier, is the director's real job, which is to take a script and to interpret it, but not change it, not have to, quote unquote, put your own stamp on it by moving scenes around or adding scenes or doing this or doing that. Just taking what's there, putting it up on the stage, and giving it life that comes from the director's mind. And David Cromer demonstrated with it just an amazing ability to make the show that we all thought we knew into something that we've never seen before, and to really help us get an idea of what it must have been like back in the late 30s to see how this show broke all the rules and sort of changed the way that Broadway and the theater thought the way things could be done. And this production does all that all over again. And it's very special. It's extraordinarily acted. It's beautifully designed, very sparsely designed, as our towns usually are. But it's absolutely stunning, and I think that if you haven't seen it, you need to go as soon as you can. David Cromer is also back in the show. He had left for a while to do directing and other projects, and he'd been replaced by a number of other actors, including Michael McKean, and Helen Hunt did it for a period of time a while ago. But he's back, and I saw him originally. He's terrific. You might know him just from his directing, but he's a darn good actor too. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. And if you saw it once, please go back. I am going to try to go back before it closes. And I hope to see some of you there, because it really is something you can go to any number of times and just be blown away every chance. So definitely, if you can, go see it. It's one of a kind. It really is.
Matthew makes an excellent point about the direction. So many times directors take a classic and they do different things to it just for the sake of being different and putting their quote-unquote stamp on it. But in this case, there's so much thought behind it. And Cromer did things that might sound like they really were not good ideas. For example, the show is written, I mean, the time and place of it are written as very specific. And the dialogue has always been, as far as I know, played with, for example, very broad New England accents to place it in Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, at the beginning of the 20th century. But Cromer does this thing where he has everyone speak in kind of more or less modern cadences and without any specific regional dialect. And it just has the effect of making it all seem so immediate and so much easier to relate to.
You know, Michael, you make a great point, of course, in talking about David Cromer's direction and how he does things that you might not normally expect. But for me, what makes his direction so special is that every choice is justified by the script. Everything he does, you can point to something in the script and say, yes, I understand why this is happening. This is related to this thing here, or maybe this thing in this other act. And that's unusual by itself, because to me, you don't ever sense the director. You don't ever see something and say, yeah, that's David Cromer. You only look at it and you say, well, that's Thornton Wilder, and that's Thornton Wilder, and this other thing, no, that's Thornton Wilder too. When that's carried over the course of 2.5 hours, you forget you're watching a play. The acting is so, as Michael pointed out, is so naturalistic and so believable that the concept of the show is basically that it's happening in the theater in real time. And the way that traditionally the productions have done this is they've set it in Grover's Corners in the early 1900s, but David Cromer has set it in 2009 and 2010. So it's unfolding literally as you're watching it, but it grows, and he justifies that concept throughout the show. The most amazing part to me is that I talked a while back when we were talking about Brighton Beach Memoirs that my concept of what David Cromer was doing there is that he was viewing Brighton Beach Memoirs and Broadway Bound as two acts of a single play. So when you saw Brighton Beach Memoirs on Broadway, if you were among the very few thousand people who had that opportunity, you were just seeing half of a larger show. But if you'd seen them both together, you would have gotten more than if you'd seen either of them individually. And to me, Our Town is really a similar example of that. He uses every millisecond of all three acts to tell this story of life in the town. And even the intermissions, the way things happen and the lighting cues, the lighting is so crucial in the show. And it's like the most subdued, laid back lighting imaginable. Everything builds up to every moment, so that everything that comes before is completely justified. And by the end, for those of you who know the show, you certainly know that the last act is difficult. There's a lot of hard stuff that happens in it. And again, there's nothing that feels false and nothing that feels like it comes out of nowhere. And that's so unusual. It's perfectly directed. It really is. It really is how you do it.
Someone could argue that what Wilder was trying to do was to show us universality in specificity.
Absolutely.
And it is written and has always been done, as far as I know, with the intention of giving the impression that it is Grover's Corners, New Hampshire in whatever, 1910 or whatever it is. And so it might have sounded like a really bad idea to do it this other way. But as it turns out, it works brilliantly. Now, would I want to see every production done this way? Maybe not, but it's just was so bracing and so original and just really breathtaking.
So just a few more things to say. We have to wrap up here pretty quickly, is that Yank is being delayed until next fall, the 2011 season. Do you guys want to say something quickly about that?
Well, we were talking about David Cromer just now with Our Town, and of course, yeah, he's attached to Yank now as a director. I don't know what this means. I think that it's probably based on the production at the York Theater earlier this year. I think it's probably a good thing if they're rewriting the book and giving it more attention. Every time I see one of these announcements, though, I always think, well, does that really mean that it's going to come in later, or does it mean it's not going to come in? And I don't know. I think that there's a lot of good stuff in Yank. I do think it needs work. Do I think that if they push it back 6 months or a year that it will magically be better than if they really focused on it now? I have no idea. I certainly hope that it comes in and we get to see what David Cromer's done with it, but just it's really hard to tell at this point. Anything could happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they've been working on Yank for so many years now. I've seen it. Three different incarnations of it, and it seems like they've made changes along the way, but to me nothing really major. And I do think that there are still some major problems with the storytelling that haven't been addressed. Supposedly there's this new draft, this new version of the script that is very different and that Cromer loves, so we'll see. But of course, on top of all that, the question, aside from how good or not good the show is it commercial enough to survive on Broadway? It would be fascinating if and really a wonderful thing, I think, if they do fix it and if it is a great success. I don't, because it focuses on really the love story of these two guys, and I'm not sure that there's been any show, unless you count La Cage, which certainly should count, that focuses on that aspect of gay life that has been successful on Broadway. Certainly not next fall. So, you know, is there an audience? Is there a general audience enough to keep a show running on Broadway for, you know, a year or whatever, about two gay servicemen in love during World War II? I guess we'll see. Or maybe we won't. And maybe the show won't come to Broadway because they won't get the backing for it.
The next thing we've been saying we'll wrap up with is that on Talking Broadway's All That Chat, Zellawoo87 posted an interesting topic. He or she posted that this will be the first season that it's a Sondheim-less season in a number of years. That we have no Stephen Sondheim show scheduled to open yet in the 2010-11 season. What do you guys think about this? I hadn't thought about it until I saw it on All That Chat.
Well, you know, the point I'd like to make is when something like that is brought up, it really would be something if somebody could figure out a way how to make a repertory company work on Broadway. Or, I mean, it's been tried and it hasn't really worked, and certainly not with musicals. I imagine they'd have to get a very kind of special arrangement with Equity and the other unions. But the fact is that there are very few shows that have the ability to pull in people night after night, week after week, month after month, to make their money back and let alone make a profit. And shows like Sondheim's especially don't tend to have that kind of mass audience tourist appeal. But if there were some way to have like this production company developed that could present like three or four Sondheim shows in rep, that would be really something. And I wonder if it could ever be workable. Something similar was done at the Kennedy Center, and that was a brilliant success artistically. I don't know how it panned out financially. What do you guys think of that? I mean, do you think is it conceivable that there could be such a repertory representation of shows like that?
Well, Michael, repertory on Broadway has not really had an illustrious history. I know that a lot of people over the decades have tried, and it really hasn't worked out. I think that the closest thing we have, and it's obviously it's very different, is City Center Encores. And from that standpoint, they do five or six performances of three shows over the course of several months, and that's it. So to me, that's probably the best that we're likely to get.
Well, we had the almost example of Brighton Beach Memoirs and
right, but that wasn't a repertory company. That was two shows that they just happened to be performing in rap.
Right, but I mean, it,
to me,
It would be. I'm sorry. That's what I mean. If they could do something like that, if somebody said, you know, I'm going to produce a season or two of Sondheim shows, and we're going to do Company, A Little Night Music, and Merrily We Roll Along, and maybe one other, and we'll have a lot of the same actors in it, but not necessarily all the same. It would really have to be special arrangements with Equity, because obviously not everyone would be doing 8 shows a week, and there would be all kinds of other issues, and not to mention the set. The set issue. So I guess it's probably not feasible, but it sure would be something if somebody could make that work someday.
I do think that's an interesting idea. And to be perfectly frank, I would actually prefer to see that than to have Roundabout spend one of its very precious Broadway slots every season bringing in a Stephen Sondheim musical that's a revival. I personally am of the opinion that we've seen far too many revivals of musicals in general, and Stephen Sondheim musicals in particular, when if we have been with certain theater companies have been less willing to do that, perhaps he would have written more new shows than yes. just really the one that we've seen in the last, however, you know, 10 years or whatever, which was Roadshow, which even there was a rewriting of Bounce, which of course was a rewriting of Wise Guys. I think that so many theater companies being dependent on Sondheim revivals or musical revivals in general to fill their slots is something that we're better off if we get away from. Now, of course, I have nothing against Stephen Sondheim, but I think that there are a lot of other composers who are worthy of revivals, or especially there are a lot of composers out there who are waiting for their big shot so that they can be the next Stephen Sondheim. And I would much rather see works from them than to see works from Sondheim that are still very much part of the cultural memory, especially given how strong the Broadway affection for Sondheim is. He's hardly unknown. He's hardly unrepresented. And Michael, as you've pointed out, many of the revivals of his shows have not done spectacular box office. They haven't torn the theater apart and set it on fire with people trying to run down and get tickets for whatever the latest one is. Most of them have done okay at best. A few have done better, but even so, they haven't transferred to commercial runs at all, I believe. And as such, they're not fantastic investment opportunities. And if that's the case, I think we're probably better off with shows that might give other people chances or might inspire Sondheim to finish work on whatever his next show is, which I'm much more interested in seeing than another revival of a Follies or Sunday in the Park with George or Pacific Overtures or whatever. We've been there. We've done that. It's time to quote a Sondheim song, Move On.
I see both of your points, and I've long hoped that there would have been some sort of theater company that is close to New York, whether it be like a Paper Mill Playhouse or even a Goodspeed or something like that, that would undertake large works of Sondheim's and mount them at their playhouses and then bring them to New York for a week. That way all the Sondheim fans can actually see these things done on a first-class production for just a week, and then it can be a quick hit in and out of the city. Because certainly the Sondheim shows, as we talked about in the Andrew Lloyd Webber stint at the top of this podcast, was that Andrew Lloyd Webber shows certainly have made money in the past years, and the Sondheim shows have gotten the critical reviews but not necessarily made the money. So hopefully we can find a balance in there someday. So I think we're going to wrap up from here. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to add?
Happy Labor Day, everyone.
Yeah, happy Labor Day. Absolutely.
Yeah, tomorrow. Enjoy the beautiful weather.
Yeah, it's a great one. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo, and there's a subscribe button for iTunes. As Matthew pointed out in previous weeks, iTunes is not the only place that you can get Broadway Radio. You can also get it on the Zune Marketplace, and I think Matthew is subscribed. He's the subscriber from the Zune Marketplace.
There's got to be one.
We've had some interesting developments in the last couple of weeks. You can now listen to our podcast, Broadway Radio and This Week on Broadway, on the Stitcher app on the iPhone and Android. So if, in fact, you wanted to listen to it and you're on the run, you can just pull us up in Stitcher, Stitcher. Search for that app and download it. It's a great little app. You can play lots of different podcasts through there.
Wow.
And you'll find us on there. Also, We are now found on Broadway World Radio 3 times a week. So you can find us there. And hopefully, if you're a new listener, you know, you can reach out and give us some feedback of what you think of our podcast by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the upper right-hand corner, there's a feedback form, and you can send us an email. Or if you'd like to call and leave a voicemail, that number is 646-873-7695. And if you leave a voicemail, we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.